From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, it's called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. The controversial method of extracting oil and gas from deep in the earth is transforming the economy in places like North Dakota and parts of Pennsylvania. Fracking has been mostly under the radar in California, but with huge deposits of oil embedded in shale along the Central Coast, fracking is getting the attention of oil companies, environmentalists, and now regulators. We'll discuss the pros and cons of fracking and new draft regulations released Tuesday by the state. We'll get started with Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. And this hour, we're looking at a controversial method of extracting oil and gas. It's called fracking, the shortened version of hydraulic fracturing. Massive amounts of water are mixed with sand and chemicals, injected under high pressure into the ground, breaking up shale rock and releasing the oil or gas. Yesterday, the state released draft regulations for fracking here in California. The state has huge deposits of oil embedded into rock along the central coast near Monterey, but environmentalists worry that fracking can damage nearby water and air as well as the land. Joining us this hour to talk about the future of fracking and the present of fracking is Lauren Sommer. She is a science and environment reporter for KQED Public Radio. And Lauren, let me begin. First of all, just by, if you would, give us a little bit of like fracking 101. What are the basics? I mentioned just a little bit of it, but go into a bit more detail if you would.
Yeah, I mean, people have heard about this, but they've heard about it in states like Pennsylvania, New York, and Colorado. It's been going on for a long time in California, but not for natural gas. That's what you've heard about in other states. It's mostly for oil here in California. And this is oil that's locked inside shale rock. So it's not easy to get out. But what fracking allows is drillers can drill down very deep. They can crack the rock with high pressure, water, and then that releases the oil. So really, it's kind of a technique that's opening up energy reserves around the country. And there's kind of new interest in California.
So there has been fracking in California for decades. What's new? What's different? Why are we suddenly having regulations or draft regulations released?
Yeah, it's for a couple of reasons. Obviously, there's a huge debate around the country, very controversial debate about what's going on. So California is kind of starting to feel those effects. But we have a very large formation of shale oil in this state. It's called the Monterey Shale. It's already produced a lot of oil, but it's the easy stuff. And now because companies have gotten very good at fracking, they're starting to kind of look at it in a new light. You know, maybe they would be able to get more oil out of this formation. So there seems to be a kind of a buzz and some political pressure. And that's why we're seeing these new regulations.
And where is this Monterey Shale? It's around Monterey, I would guess.
Yeah, it goes from Central California all the way down to Southern California. It's very large. But no one's really sure how easy it is to kind of get this shale oil out.
And is it all in the land or is some of it out in the ocean as well?
This is mostly land-based that we're talking about in terms of fracking. There is obviously offshore oil in California, but this is kind of where people are starting to look at it.
And when you say a lot of, you know, oil, how much are we talking about?
Well, there's one estimate. It's more than 15 billion barrels of oil that could be recovered. Now, that number is a little bit flexible because there's a lot down there, but no one's exactly sure if it's easy to get out or not, or economical to get out.
And how much is that? Give me some context for that.
It's a lot. It's, you know, people may have heard about North Dakota. They're having an oil boom right now. Their reserve is about 3 to 4 billion barrels is one estimate. So obviously 15 is a lot more than that.
California has more of everything. So these new regulations, what are some of the highlights?
Yeah. So one of the themes is disclosure, right? Before, oil companies never had to say where they were fracking in California. And so with these new regulations, they're going to have to tell the state within 10 days before they hydraulically fracture a well. The state has said within 7 days of that, they'll post that information on an online website, which, you know, if you do the math, leads to about 3 days, hypothetically, as the minimum that the public would have notice that this was going to happen.
Why so little time?
Well, that's what they think is kind of feasible. But one of the early kind of criticisms is that, you know, if you're a landowner or in a community where this is happening, you would have to be checking this site every day because there's no rule that says oil companies actually have to notify landowners nearby.
And the chemicals that are used, what kind of disclosure is being proposed in the regulations?
Yeah, around the country, this has been one of the most controversial things. The rules say that some of these chemicals, you know, they include diesel compounds, some known carcinogens. Companies would have to say what they're injecting and what the concentrations are except if they believe that it's a trade secret. And in that case, they only really have to say what family that the chemical's from.
And that's a big exception.
It is a big exception. And what we've seen in other states, recently Texas, they're finding that these exemptions are used a lot. And one of the authors who wrote the law in Texas kind of came out last week and said, you know, this has become a loophole. People are really taking advantage of it.
And so the regulations that have been proposed this week, would it bring California more or less in line with the regulations in other states, or would they be tougher in some ways or different?
Yeah, we're kind of middle of the road. There are some things that are required that would be required here, but other states don't require. You know, one is before you hydraulically fracture a well, that you would have to look for old wells or faults in the area that could potentially be a conduit for these fracking fluids to kind of get up into the drinking water supply. That is something California is doing that other states don't do. But then there's a few other things that were probably about average.
Yeah. And of course, as you just alluded to, environmentalists and others are concerned about pollution of groundwater, of air, and potentially of land. So is there a sense that these regulations begin to address those questions?
Yeah. What state regulators, this is the Division of Oil and Gas here in California, have said is that some of those issues, they aren't quite sure if they fall under their jurisdiction or some other agencies, the air and the water agencies in the state. So certainly there's a big concern with air pollution and methane, which is a pretty potent greenhouse gas, which comes out of wells. And there's obviously a concern with groundwater supply. But they're saying they're in discussions with other agencies about how to deal with those issues.
And these areas in California where the shale is, there's a lot of agriculture in those areas, grapes and many other crops.
Yeah. And, you know, talking to some people where actually it was just last week, the Bureau of Land Management held a very large oil lease sale, about 18,000 acres in Central California. And so certainly in Central California and Monterey County, we're seeing people starting to get concerned about this.
That is Lauren Sommer, who is a science and environment reporter for KQED Public Radio. We're talking this hour about fracking and new regulations released this week, yesterday, as a matter of fact, by the state of California. And let's broaden the conversation a bit. Let's bring in Bill Alio, who is a California Director of Government Affairs for the Environmental Working Group. And he joins us this morning from Sacramento. Is that right?
That's right. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks to you for being here. Also with us, Catherine Ree Heiss Boyd. She's president of the Western States Petroleum Association. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
Well, let me get your take, Catherine Ree Heiss Boyd, if I could. What is your sense of these regulations? Do they seem fair? Are there concerns that your group has?
Well, I mean, of course, as everyone, and I appreciate Lauren Sommer's giving the sort of overview, because we are beginning, as ourselves, as everyone is, looking at these regulations, just recently received them, so we're diving into them ourselves. But given that, I do appreciate at least the process that the division is going through to engage the public. As you know, this is a discussion draft, but that discussion draft came after multiple listening sessions that the Division of Oil and Gas held throughout the state, which I thought was valuable. They were certainly vocal and in some areas contentious, but I think that was all healthy in giving the division a sense of people's concerns and how we can make sure whatever rulemaking comes out of this addresses those, and that's always a good thing. So I think having a discussion draft, which will start the conversations with all the stakeholders, including Bill and I have talked about this through all of last year and have a very good working relationship as we dive into these issues and address them either regulatorily or legislatively. I'm sure there, as we know, there's been a bill introduced as well, so there'll be a legislative discussion and a rulemaking regulatory discussion around this. So it's a good starting point for the discussion. The rulemaking itself won't be formalized until February, and then that will go into the formal process, which I think is going to take 8 to 10 months. So I think it's going to be a very comprehensive review. I think that will hopefully give people comfort as we dive into the pre-fracturing well testing, the advanced notification, the monitoring issues, the disclosure issues. Some of the storage and handling of the fluids at the surface. So lots of work to do on it.
Yeah, and the 18,000 acres of leases that were sold just recently, does that give the owners of those leases now the opportunity to begin sinking wells even before these regulations are enacted?
Well, and as we, you know, as I think even Lauren pointed out, there are existing regulations in place, and the whole issue really around hydraulic fracturing focuses on the integrity of the well. If the well is the integrity of the well is maintained, then hydraulic fracturing is not any different than any other oil stimulating production technique. And those regulations are in place, have been in place, and it's the reason, frankly, there has been no evidence of groundwater contamination. Air quality issues have been addressed through multiple permits, as we will find as we go through this process, and there hasn't been any reported incidents in 60 years. So the regulations are in place. I think the one thing that I really appreciated from Lauren is that there is a lot of discussion on this nationally, and that discussion has, as you know, been fairly heated. And so it has brought to the attention, not that the practice is new necessarily, certainly the technology has advanced and it is of more interest, but there have been regulations in place in California on this practice. What we're doing now is making sure that people who don't know are getting comfortable with what we're doing, how we're doing it, and that we're protecting the environment while we're doing it. And Bill, that is a good, positive conversation that we're very happy to engage in.
Bill Alio, what would you add to that? Catherine Rehise-Boyd talks about the integrity of the well being the most critical thing. What would you add to that list?
Where to start? This is really complicated. I've been working on it for 2 years, and first I want to say the oil companies have been very cooperative in trying to get disclosure legislation through our state capitol and signed by the governor. We didn't do it the last 2 years, but they're working with us to do it. I think their strategy has been to not have the feds regulate this, the EPA, but to go state by state. So California is one of those states. I want to add a little bit to what your science reporter Lauren said, is that it's more than the Monterey Shale. They've been fracking other geologic formations, especially in Los Angeles and Kern County, for many years. And as she said, the easy oil is gone, so fracking became more and more popular to get the tougher to extract stuff out, plus other well stimulation techniques and enhanced oil recovery things were steam flooding, acid matrix stimulation, the injection of acid at pressure. In fact, that may be the best technique for using them in the Monterey Shale, we're finding out, or we're hearing. We don't know, obviously. Let me point out another couple things. One is that the companies themselves in their Securities and Exchange Commission filings say fracking is risky because of the threat of spills, explosions. You're working with very toxic chemicals. And then let me address, is there a problem in California from it? And as Catherine says, we don't have any known examples. That's what the Division of Oil and Gas says. Where's the problem? Well, we don't know where fracking has occurred for the last 50 years. So we can't say a farmer could pull up something in his well and not know, why is there benzene in my well, or not even know the benzene was in his well because the well was fracked near him. Now,
has that happened, though? I mean, have farmers done that?
Actually, the documented pollution problems in groundwater have been from the percolation ponds, from the produced water that's come up, and then it percolates into the groundwater. And there are known cases of that in California. There are cases around the country. They're hotly disputed as to whether the groundwater has been polluted by fracking. We think it has been. But in California, we don't have specific fracking has caused this pollution cases. On the other hand, where has the fracking occurred? And let me then get to the well casing integrity and the safety. The Division of Oil and Gas says their bread and butter is ensuring integrity of wells in California. And to do that, they have well casing regulations that are great. So that's why you don't see problems. Well, so if you ask them, well, let me say that the oil companies admit openly 3 to 8% on average, about 5% of well casings fail. So if you say to the Division of Oil and Gas, where have those occurred? They go, we can't really tell you. You can't? Well, if you ask us on a well-by-well basis, we will. Well, there's 55,000 approximately wells in California, so we're supposed to go through them one by one. There's no database that shows whether some operators have been worse, some geologic formations are more risky.
So is part of the regulation change proposed here to create more of a database that's more easily searchable?
It's reading between the lines, yeah. It says that these well casing failures are supposed to be reported, but the division admits their well casing regulations need updating. So here they are saying that's our bread and butter. We relied upon everything safe. But, oh, by the way, they need revisions too. And that's next in order after the fracking regulations. So we're worried about that.
Yeah. And Catherine Rehise-Boyd, the disclosure of the chemicals seems to be a big issue. A recent report by Bloomberg showed that I think 1 in 5 chemicals were not disclosed, companies saying that they were trade secrets. So it seems like there's a situation where people are being asked to trust oil companies that, that the chemicals being used are safe, but there is no requirement that they be revealed. Is that an accurate description?
Well, it's not totally accurate, but, you know, I think over the last, especially over the last year, there's been a concerted effort, certainly nationally, and I can say the producers in California have definitely got on the bandwagon to report and disclose on frackfocus.org website, which is a website managed by the Groundwater Protection Council and the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. And that commission is representative of, you know, 34 states and run by the governors of those states. So the frackfocus.org website, I think, is a really good vehicle. It's easy to get online and look at what wells have been hydraulic refract, how much water has been used, what are the chemicals. And so I think that's going to serve us well going forward so that the public feels they have someplace they can go. And
but that doesn't really address the question of trade secrets, does it?
Yeah, and I'll get to that. But you asked both questions about disclosure. So there is a vehicle for disclosing these. Now, when you get into the trade secret issue, as you know, in California, companies and individuals certainly have a right to protect trade secret, and all of that is about really, I think, the benefit ends up being the consumer, because in the end, trade secrets are really not about oil companies as much as they are in promoting competition, and that competition always benefits the public. So that's the issue around trade exposure.
But you do see the downside, don't you, and the concern about not revealing what the chemical is?
And I think that, you know, you certainly know the chemical family. So, but I think the struggle is how much, you know, how much is enough and how much can you protect competition from competitors? I mean, there are many other incidents that, other than hydraulic fracturing, where businesses do not want to disclose to their competitors for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Because so that's what we're struggling with. How much is enough, and how much will give enough comfort to the public that they have enough detail versus how much can protect a competitive trade secret? So, and that's what we'll work through in this process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't have one over the other. They are both important, and we need to work through what that right balance is.
Lauren Sommer, is that striking that balance, is that an important outcome of these regulations and the process it's about to go through with the hearings and so on?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I think is interesting is the Division of Oil and Gas said that they would support legislation that would allow the public to kind of challenge these trade secret exemptions because, you know, they've said that they're the ones looking at whether these trade secrets are warranted or not, but the public doesn't really have a role. So that is one thing the division did say when they released these regulations.
Wouldn't it be possible if the concern is, I mean, obviously there are several concerns. One is protecting trade secrets, which seems like a legitimate concern, but there's also, of course, protecting groundwater and public safety and health. And is there some way to have a panel to whom these chemicals could be disclosed for safety purposes without revealing, you know, to the competitors what the chemicals are so that they could at least be, you know, tested or confirmed for being safe?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things people are going to be talking about a lot going forward with these regulations because, you know, how does kind of California parse that information? You know, who decides? You can kind of see that this is going to be one of the issues people are really going to focus on in the future.
Bill Elio, as these draft regulations are poured over and hearings begin, what are some of the most important things you want to raise right at the start?
First thing is that a lot of this is built in as trust the oil companies. That the Division of Oil and Gas admits they don't have enough staff to be everywhere at once to observe well pressure tests, to go out if something's happening in the field. Yes, the blowouts happen, they'll be there. But the day-to-day stuff is basically trust the oil companies. That's been that way for 100 years with Dogger. In fact, I would go further and say that Dogger, the state agency, has been there at the beck and call of the oil companies for 100 years. And really the headlights we've shown on fracking has been a really good thing for the state agency. They're finally getting some public scrutiny to see, are they doing the right good job? Are they protecting the public interest? Or are they just there to get oil and gas companies their permits ASAP? So we think it's more the latter. And so they're entering, we think, a new phase of public accountability, and that's a good thing.
I just want to point out, excuse me, we did invite someone from the California Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, or DOGGR, as you call them, to provide a representative this morning, and they declined. So, but go ahead, Bill. Sorry.
So the basic thrust of these regulations are when you submit an intent to drill a well, it's like an application. You could call it a permit. DOGGR has 10 days to approve it or it's deemed approved. They have to approve it or deny it or it's deemed approved. You can just go drill the well. So these new fracking regulations just are built right into that. They'll submit this area of safety review looking at the adjoining geologic formations, faults, groundwater, and other wells and say, this is what we plan to do in terms of the frack job. It looks safe to us, and here's our intent to drill the well. DOGGR will have 10 days to review this and say, okay. We don't think that's a very rigorous permit process compared to any other state agency or even local permitting agencies. Second, I think a major shortcoming here is public notice. To have people who live in an oil drilling area look at the website every day to find out if a well is going to be drilled and fracked near them is basically absurd. If you come home from work and see a drill rig going with diesel pumps going, you know, drilling the well and they're injecting who knows what, I don't think that's fair. Why can't, like when someone's building a project in your neighborhood, you get a notice by mail this is about to occur? That's what we've asked for in the state legislature. The oil companies blocked this legislation this last year. Get that notice. Tell your neighbor we're going to do a project. Give them a phone number to call so they can talk to the Division of Oil and Gas or the driller and say, I have some questions. And we're not asking for an appeal process, a new oil and gas commission. Just let your neighbor know. And the oil companies have objected to that. They've said, you'll just scare people. We think knowledge is good for people. They'll be less scared. Third is the trade secrets issue. And this is a big one because, as Lauren Sommer pointed out, a recent analysis of all the states that have been dealing with this, and there is some data on California, shows that trade secrets are being exercised very frequently as opposed to 2 years ago when I started looking at this. We told it'll be rare. It is rare. And the co-author of the Texas legislation, a Democrat, said, we've built an exemption in here big enough to drive a Mack truck through, and he wouldn't do it the same way. So I think states are starting to re-examine the whole trade secret issue, and trade secrets are important. We have a Uniform Trade Secret Act. People think of the easiest example as the formula for Coca-Cola. There are competitive edges. On the other hand, Halliburton, one of the biggest fracking companies in the world, told us people catch up to our technology. We keep changing the formulas, and we change them for the geologic formation and also to stay ahead of our competitors so we can say, as opposed to Schlumberger or Baker Hughes, we'll give you the most efficient frack job, Chevron or Occidental, when they come in to do it. We understand all that. On the other hand, this has to be balanced between the public knowing or a neighbor or a farmer knowing what's going down. So why can't people just know the chemical? They don't have to know the exact formula, the parts per million. I want to know if benzene, xylene, diesel fuel, formaldehyde, carcinogens all are being pumped in the ground next to me 24 hours from now, a week from now. Give me a notice. Tell me what the chemicals are. Why the big secrecy? If the companies are saying it's so safe, they don't make mistakes, there's no groundwater pollution, give us some good information in advance. Let people know. Post the stuff soon thereafter. And I haven't talked about what are called confidential wells, where they'll be able to hide what was put into the ground for 2 to 4 years if they're called confidential wells.
We can come back to some of those issues. That's Bill Alio from the Environmental Working Group. He'll be with us for the rest of the hour, along with Catherine Rehise-Boyd from the Western States Petroleum Association and Lauren Sommer here from KQED Public Radio, our science and environment reporter. If you'd like to join us with questions or comments about fracking, the number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning, and our topic this hour is fracking, also known as hydraulic fracturing, a somewhat controversial method of extracting gas and oil from the ground. And our guest this hour, Lauren Sommer, science and environment reporter for KQED Public Radio. Also, Catherine Rehise-Boyd, who is president of the Western States Petroleum Association, and Bill Alio, California Director of Government Affairs for the Environmental Working Group. Here are some comments from our Facebook page, and let me give the phone number out again before I read those. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join us for the rest of the hour, 866-733-6786. We asked on our Facebook page, do the benefits of fracking outweigh the risks? And here are some of the comments. Mark writes, how can anybody think that pumping toxic wastewater deep into the ground is safe? Raymond writes, this is precisely the wrong turn in the fight to prevent global warming. The solution to global warming does not include releasing more CO2 into the atmosphere. Rather, we must curb carbon dioxide release. Another listener writes, the industry routinely tries to conflate the safety of vertical gas drilling in use for over a century with horizontal fracking in use for a little over a decade, a method which deploys a potent arsenal of chemicals so hazardous they defy known waste treatment methods. And Eric writes, yeah, more jobs, more oil, the consumer wins, and this technology has been utilized for years, much ado about nothing. And then we've got a comment from Wes who writes, I think the regulatory questions surrounding fracking are not the questions we should be asking. It's more important to consider why it's necessary to take all that carbon out of the ground in the first place. Since burning so much carbon is known to be detrimental to all, just leave it in the ground. Questions about climate change, and maybe we'll touch on those a little more later in the hour. Joining us right now, Kathleen McGinty, who is Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Strategic Growth for Weston Solutions. They're an environmental engineering firm, and she's also former Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and Chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality under President Clinton. Kathleen McGinty, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott. Pleased to join the discussion.
Well, you folks back east have a lot more experience with this than we do here in California, at least in recent years. And tell us what you've learned back there about fracking and what we should be thinking about in California as we begin to enact new regulations.
Well, thanks much. And we have seen tremendous growth over just a few years in the number and presence of especially on gas, the gas side of the oil and gas equation of fractured wells. Two things I think are very important. First, from an economic and national security and even on an environmental point of view or perspective, shale oil and shale gas are an important resource for the United States. But the second and equally important point is that we have to have very effective regulations. We have to have effective enforcement of those regulations, and we have to enable the public to have transparency and to be engaged in the process.
And all those things, regulations, enforcement of those, transparency, I mean, do you feel that states that are now highly engaged with fracking, say North Dakota, Pennsylvania, have they achieved those ends?
I think that we've made some progress. In Pennsylvania, for example, there was, under our previous governor, a significant ramping up in the number of enforcement staff that we have in the field. Still, I think more investment is needed there. Another important thing is what we call baseline environmental sampling. What's important about that is it enables the public to have a very clear view as to what the condition of the environment was before the hydraulic fracturing started, and then if there is any adverse impact on water or air quality, we'd have that data to be able to understand what's happening. So things like that are not uniform across the United States, but they really are important.
Just before we introduced you, you may have heard some of the listener comments that we had, and a number of people touched on this question of global warming and, you know, why are we even making ourselves more dependent on carbon-based fuel? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, look, I think every energy form and renewable energy in particular is becoming an increasingly important part of the mix. But the data right now shows that because there has been such a significant production of gas, the price of gas has come down. And what I mean by that is natural gas. That's led to some of the dirtiest fuel from a global warming point of view being pushed out of the electricity mix in pretty dramatic fashion. So you have what's called coal to gas switching with a lot more natural gas coming on. And that has led to a pretty significant drop for the first time in decades, a significant drop in greenhouse gas emissions in the United States.
And what about this? I'm sure that this is very much a part of, say, the Obama administration's push toward energy independence. The more domestic oil and gas production we have, the less we need to rely on OPEC countries. How does that figure into all this?
Well, I think we can't miss the importance from a national security point of view. We know that our country has been exposed to great danger as we've had to go to far-flung parts of the planet in search of energy. And so any step, including natural gas and domestically sourced oil, that enables us to keep that money at home, to keep our energy dependence local as opposed to in far-flung places, is a boost to our security. I think also the economic piece is important. A lot of people don't realize that one of the biggest pieces of our trade deficit is not just things that we purchase from China, but actually the borrowing of money from places like China to buy those energy resources from abroad. That's actually one of the biggest, if not the biggest, chunks of our trade deficit. So keeping those dollars at home and investing here is important. The last thing I just say on the environmental piece, you know, we should have a broader conversation. Right now, because gas is cheap, it's actually hurting the gas companies, but it's also very hurtful to the renewable energy companies who find it hard to now finance their projects. So what do? One important thought would be to say, you know what, gas can be used for things other than energy, and specifically as feedstock into chemicals and other high-value products. Maybe that's where we should put the priority in terms of the use of these new feedstocks.
And, of course, some might say this is a great time to put a bit of a tax on carbon-based fuel, on oil and gas.
Well, it's funny how that conversation goes. It's when energy prices are high, well, my goodness, we can't afford to put a tax on it now. And when energy prices are low, well, my goodness, the economy's not strong enough, we can't put a tax on. But I do think that we should realize as a country that for decades we have provided subsidy for various energy resources, fossil energy resources, nuclear energy resources. In the last couple of years, for the first time, we put in place consistent support for renewables, and what happened? They doubled in capacity and they dropped significantly in price. The way to go is to make sure we've got a level playing field and we are supporting those energy resources that can provide secure, clean, and reliable energy for us today and into the future.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you, California is about to embark on this process of enacting regulations, and whenever you do that, you've got different interest groups on different sides, the environmentalists on one side, consumer groups, the oil industry on the other side. If you could enact one or two specific regulations that you think the oil industry wouldn't like or is going to fight, what would they be?
Well, look, I think the first priority is what is referred to as well integrity. That is standards, regulations, requirements that ensure that the development of the well is done in proper and safe fashion. Now, the reason why that is particularly important with hydraulic fracturing is that, unlike conventional development, in this case, the well actually goes through the aquifer. It goes past where you are drawing your drinking water from. So it is incredibly important that the well is developed properly. But here's where I would push the envelope. Those are some of the basic protections you have to have in mind. In a place like California, where water is scarce, I think the sustainability of the gas and oil industry needs to be going in a direction of very significantly reducing its water footprint, not just not polluting the water, but actually going to zero net consumption of water, cleaning water, conserving water. That would be a big challenge, but I have to believe in a place like California, it would be vitally important.
And then last question, there are a lot of claims and counterclaims and misconceptions about fracking. Based on what you've seen, what's the biggest misconception that you'd like to clear up?
Well, I think the biggest worry that the public has is that the fracturing fluids themselves, that mixture of chemicals you referred to that's used in the fracturing process, that those chemicals are getting into people's drinking water and that those chemicals are presenting a health risk in that water. That we have not observed. the focus really needs to be, again, in terms of well integrity, because where water quality has been compromised is not in the fracturing fluids getting into the water, but in there being leaks in the well so that the gas or the oil migrates into the drinking water. That is a problem. It is preventable, and we ought to keep our eye on that ball.
All right. Kathleen McGinty, Senior Vice President with Weston Solutions, an environmental engineering firm back east. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
All right. And let's go to our listeners now. And first stop, Los Altos and Harn is on the line. Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think your previous speaker really hit the issue correctly, and that's water availability. You know, anything east of the Dakotas seems to have enough precipitation that could support water for fracking. But west of the Dakotas, and particularly in California, I mean, we're really in deep trouble on water. And so how much water does it take to frack? And maybe we're at a greater risk of reaching peak water than we are at peak oil.
Yeah. Lauren Sommer, can you give us some numbers or give us a sense of just how much water it does take?
Yeah, this has kind of been an interesting part of the debate, because in the east, where they are fracking for natural gas, the millions of gallons of water are used in each well. But here in California, because it's oil, a lot of people in the industry are saying we don't need quite as much water here, because in oil formations, there's already a lot of water down there. So I think we're going to see this play out a little bit more. I mean, I think it goes without saying water is a huge issue in California.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Harn. We've had a number of comments from listeners about earthquakes. And there's some discussion about whether fracking can trigger earthquakes. Lauren, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of top of mind for Californians, right?
Yeah.
The issue is not so much with the fracking itself. It's actually with the wastewater. What happens is a lot of times oil companies inject the wastewater back into the ground in wells. And that creates a lot of sustained pressure over time that actually can cause earthquakes. We've kind of seen one or two cases around the country, very small earthquakes being caused this way. I think this is going to continue to be an issue. The state has said it's a different set of regulations that actually deal with the wastewater treatment process, the injection underground. But I think it's definitely going to be an issue people care about a lot.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Patrick is on the line in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have asthma, and it's pretty serious sometimes. I know that there is a link between fracking and air pollution, that various kinds of pollutants from this process get into the air, and that they've been linked to health problems. And I think one thing that concerns me about these new regulations is that they don't seem to do anything to address that. They don't address the methane emissions. They don't address the other air pollution issues. It just seems like people with respiratory problems are being told, fend for yourself.
Hmm. Bill Elio, what is there a connection that you see between air pollution or asthma in Patrick's case and fracking?
Well, first, it's true that probably 99% of the fracking in California is done for oil, not gas. And the evidence we have about asthma has been with the gas emissions, the methane fracking that we see in a number of other states we don't have here. But the oil and gas drilling process itself has emissions associated with it. While they're drilling, and there can be leaks from the pipe fittings and stuff afterwards, the Division of Oil and Gas says that's our air board's purview, not ours. So they don't really have rules about it, other than, you know, the fittings themselves all have high integrity. But we're looking at that, because if there's a fracking revolution in California based on the Monterey Shale, whether they're using acid jobs or traditional frack jobs or steam flooding, whatever enhanced oil recovery method they use, there's going to be more wells drilled in California. Probably air quality is third on our list. We're trying to get public notice and the chemical disclosure and the water use and the earthquakes, and then we get air quality. So fortunately, in California, we have good air boards for the most part. So that's why we're able to put it fourth or fifth on our list. I'm not downplaying asthma concerns or air quality concerns, but the escape of methane in the environment is a huge problem in the world, because it's 25 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. So although California may not have a big methane escape problem, it's a giant problem for the world. And as callers and people have written in, what about climate change and this new extraction technology?
But you're pretty concerned about earthquakes.
Well, as Lauren said, the earthquakes have been associated with injection of wastewater, but they've now reviewed the Oklahoma cases and said it may have been the fracking itself. We find no research done on this. Now, it may occur, but I've looked and looked for 2 years and find that we aren't really looking. The oil companies say, look, we have so many geophysicists in this state, you can't turn a corner without running into one. They would know if we're causing earthquakes. But the Division of Oil and Gas says we don't really look at it. So now these new regs will say, look at the faults close to where you're fracking. We're also interested in looking at the underground injection program and whether they're working near bigger faults. It's a bit unexplored as far as we can tell.
All right. Here's an email from Caitlin in Santa Rosa who writes, where does the material go in this process? Do they dump it back out as they pump it in? Does it get left in the ground? If it gets left in the ground, how could it not eventually make its way into the water stream? Lauren Summer?
Yeah, there's a kind of a couple of ways to deal with it. The industry here says a lot of the water is reused so that it's injected back into the oil well to kind of get more oil out. You know, in other states, this has been a really big issue because, you know, for a while, people were trying to treat it in wastewater treatment plants. That wasn't working. There's some recycling requirements for kind of this wastewater. But, you know, and the one thing that kind of was new in these regulations is that the state is requiring, if they're going to put it in these open pits, these pits have to be lined so that there's protection that this isn't seeping out. That was a new thing in the regs.
But we've heard that before in California. I mean, I'm forgetting the name of it, but is it Kesterson? There have been things that have been toxic materials that have been put in pits with linings that have leaked, have there not?
Yeah.
Is there a new technology to make them, you know, to seal them better?
I mean, in a lot of states, there was a question of unlined pits or lined pits. I mean, they're kind of very basic technology. But, you know, I think we're kind of starting to see more light being shed on some of this stuff. As Bill said, you know, the public attention hasn't been focused too much in California on some of these issues.
Yeah. Catherine, go ahead, Bill, quickly.
Cases of groundwater pollution from these open pits in Kern County where farmers' water was definitely polluted. They won the case in court. Oil companies are paying up. I also want to point out the geology here in California isn't comparable to other states in many ways, and that's what our Division of Oil and Gas says. Rest assured, we are not the Marcellus Shale or the Bakken Shale. I say I'm more worried because we have a more complex geology. It's ever-shifting, seismically active, very complex. The Monterey Shale is a great example of that. In some places, it's exposed at the surface. In other places, you'll find it 20,000, 8,000 feet below. It's all over the place and twisted and folded. So we don't know exactly where groundwater moves. It's very complex. So if you inject toxic chemicals, even 5,000 gallons of them at 6,000 feet, who's to say they won't end up at 500 feet 25 years from now, even at dilute amounts, because we know now that even parts per million can affect the reproductive system of humans.
Kathy Reyes-Boyd, let me just ask you, the regulations that were released, the draft regulations released yesterday, is there anything in there that your group couldn't live with?
I don't think I can answer that quite yet because we're still diving into it. But there is something, Scott, that I think has been missing from the conversation. And certainly all the concerns that have been raised are concerns that anyone would have on any kind of technology that they're unaware of. Now, we feel very confident that this is a great technology and it's very needed and that this process will prove that it is done safely. I'm not saying that there aren't areas that we can't improve upon, that these regulations will maybe afford us the opportunity to give people more comfort and we can build additional safeguards into the regulations to achieve that. And all of that will be healthy, good, and the ultimate outcome will be that it will allow us in California to continue to produce the valuable resource we have. And I think what people sometimes forget is that there are many competing policies here, and in particular in California, 96% of our transportation fuel is derived from petroleum, and that's 42 million gallons of gasoline a day and 11 million gallons of diesel a day that consumers expect to be delivered to them in adequate supplies and in an uninterruptible fashion. And we only produce 30% of what we need in crude oil in California. And so the rest comes from other places and mostly from foreign imports. So as we're trying to transition into a low carbon economy and have all more alternative and renewables, and that's going to take time to do, we still have projections out to 2035 that 80% of our needs are going to be produced by coal, gas, and oil.
Yeah.
So we can't just forget about the fact that this is an important important resource, we certainly have to do it in a way that is protective. But we have 38% of what we need. We have 96% of our fuels that are derived from petroleum. And if we stopped all of this tomorrow, we would have a revolution in California for people who expect to get up every day and drive from A to B affordably, turn their lights on, and heat and cool their homes.
Of course, no one's talking about stopping it,
though. Right, I know, but we hear some questions, as we did from some of the folks that are calling in, that we should not continue to promote all of this. And that's a transition that we have to be very careful with, because the alternative and renewables are not coming at the rate that some expected, and we have to make sure that transition is done in a way that we can all continue to have growth in the economy. And, you know, for California, we've got 21,000 jobs that are linked to the production of oil and gas. And so we really need to have the conversation in the broadest sense, and then make sure that these questions that people have are addressed. They are legitimate concerns, especially for folks that have never even heard of hydraulic fracturing and are now concerned about what they're hearing in the media, the conversations nationally. So transparency, disclosure, making sure the environmental protections are in place, those are all very positive conversations. And I just think the other important point that was raised by, I think, one of your callers is, again, just, you know, what is in the material, what is in the water itself? The fluids is continuing to be an issue, and 99.5% of it is water and sand. The rest 5% is the chemicals that people are talking about and concerned about. Many of those are found in common household products.
But some of them are carcinogens.
But and also, though, they're put in place to make sure that the integrity of the equipment, like many of them are to reduce friction, inhibit scaling, control corrosion, and inhibit the growth of bacteria, they're put in place so the integrity of the equipment used in hydraulic fracturing further protects groundwater so that the equipment itself does not fail. So it is a very complicated discussion, and I'm glad we're having it.
Doesn't it strike you as odd? And I understand the competitive nature of oil companies, of course, but you know, if the chemicals that are of concern, the ones that are trade secrets, are also ones that are, you know, they're dangerous, but they're also, because they're also used to maintain the integrity of the well. I mean, shouldn't we all want to use the very best chemicals to maintain the integrity of the well, even if they're trade secrets?
Well, of course, and we are, but that's not a trade secret issue. I mean, that's happening. That's what companies do, right? I mean, they want to use the best materials and chemicals as possible.
So the chemicals that are trade secrets, what advantage do they give companies?
It's sort of like, look at gasoline, right? I mean, it's the most competitive entity between oil companies. And so the recipe, the additive, is the most protected trade secret there is. It's what customers get attached to and why they choose one gas station over another, right? Either it's, you know, it's
I thought that was price.
Well, it's also loyalty is tied to how they feel about that product. And that is tied to what companies put in as additives that make it their brand. And there is loyalty attached to that brand, and then therefore there is market attached to that brand. So it's no different for any competitive trade secret. It's your competitive advantage, and it's what provides the consumer the best price on the market. So again, I mean, I'm not saying it's not something we are going to look at in this series of regulations, but it isn't as, you know, we should or shouldn't. It's what, and again, I'll say it clearly, that from our standpoint, it's what's the right balance to achieve both.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Angela is on the line. Hi, Angela.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Actually, you're covering the topic perfectly on the trade secrets. And for me as a consumer, I'm hearing a lot about disclosure, accountability, transparency. And there's a couple of things I've not heard, which is when we're talking about trade secrets, you know, I would like information as a consumer to make the best decision that's good for me. And definitely one of the questions you've raised is the carcinogens. And I kind of thought that was dodged a little, because if there's carcinogens, I'd like to know. If there's health risks for me, I'd like to know. And I'd like there to be precaution taken around that, rather than kind of putting it all out, going for it, and then years later finding out that there's actually really serious health implications for people who've been kind of told that this is good for our health, this is good for consumers, there'd be a revolution tomorrow if this didn't happen. But, you know, what about the health implications and the health costs of all of this?
Lauren Sommer, we should be clear, the carcinogen is not, I mean, it's not about in the oil. It's the concern is that it would be in the groundwater, right?
Absolutely, it's in the groundwater, which is even more kind of insidious, because then how do we know that our organic food products are actually really organic, because there's going to be things that people just aren't able to test. And as long as this is all captured under competitive trade secrets, it seems to me that I have trouble hearing the words accountability and disclosure and transparency in the same sentence as trade secrets that are going to be good for consumers.
Yeah,
I think there are two issues to really focus on here. You know, one is the well construction, as we've heard a lot about this hour. You know, how well are they constructing these wells? Are they being monitored? That's certainly something to pay attention to, because that's what's going to keep the stuff down there that we're concerned about. And two is the issue of kind of a baseline monitoring data. I think we're going to hear a lot more about this. Around the country, it's been difficult to make these connections because nobody really knows what was in the water before the activity started. So I think that's another thing to pay attention to around this issue.
All right, Angela, thanks so much for the call.
Can I add
real quick, because we're right at the end here.
The conundrum of, you know, I drive a car too, I need oil. But the core issue here is the Division of Oil and Gas up to the task of regulating the industry properly. That's what we're looking at. And we have great question as to whether they can, because they're putting a lot of trust in the industry. Yesterday, they just told us, look, the oil companies don't want to lose money. If their well doesn't operate efficiently, if they're having a leak, that's bad for them. So they're going to want to fix that. Yeah, that's true. Chevron doesn't want to waste money. But is our state agency acting like a state agency? Are we entrusting them in protecting the public good, the public resource? Will these regulations do it? We have major questions about whether they will.
Okay. Bill Elio, thanks so much for being with us this hour. He's with the Environmental Working Group. Thanks also to Catherine Rehise-Boyd from the Western States Petroleum Association, Lauren Sommer from KQED Public Radio, and earlier in the hour, Kathleen McGinty from Weston Solutions. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Rob Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.